Let's turn again to Isaiah chapter 40. We're going to be looking at a number of verses in this chapter, but let's read together verse 17 as a sort of summary of everything. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. A few weeks ago, we were considering godly conduct in public worship with a focus on the fear of God. Then last week, we tried to hammer in that nail with 40 blows of the hammer by looking at 40 truths about the fear of God. I want to, this evening, take this subject a bit further, and we want to look this evening at one of the ingredients of the fear of God, because surely that's a question that arises as we've considered this subject. What actually is the fear of God, and how do I get it? Well, again, I can only recommend most highly to you Pastor Martin's book, The Forgotten Fear. His third chapter addresses the ingredients of the fear of God. He lists them as three main ingredients. Number one, a correct concept of the character of God. A correct concept of the character of God. Number two, a widespread sense of the presence of God. In other words, wherever we go, we have a sense of the presence of God. And thirdly, a constant awareness of our obligations to God. So this evening, we're really looking at that first ingredient, a correct concept of the character of God. The more correct we can be in our thoughts about who God is, then the more fear of God will grow. Pastor Martin says in that chapter, one of the great problems of our day is that we have in great measure lost sight of those aspects of God's character that are calculated to produce his fear, namely his majesty, immensity, holiness, and unrivaled sovereignty as the reigning monarch of the universe. And we'll be touching on really most of these this evening, but especially that latter description, the unrivaled sovereignty of God as the reigning monarch of the universe. And that's what's brought before us here in this chapter. And one of the reasons it's brought before us is because this chapter was written to Israel at a time when they had severe doubts about the sovereignty of God. They were going to be carried into Babylon, and Isaiah 40 and onwards was written with the understanding that they would be in Babylon one day and need to be comforted there with God's word. That's why this chapter begins, comfort you, my people. So the chapter 40 onwards assumes God's people in exile in a foreign land, having lost everything, subject to a foreign nation and foreign gods, in which it looked like for all the world that God had been defeated. Jehovah, the God of Israel, was weak and helpless before the gods of Babylon. Now Isaiah was about to promise them that one day they would be delivered from their captivity. They would be rescued. They would be returned to their own land. That was part of the comfort they were to be given. But as we'll see as we go through this chapter, they had serious doubts about the possibility of this. It never, ever happened before in the ancient world. Never before had a nation been carried into foreign captivity and returned to their own land. No, nations carried into captivity just disappeared. They ceased to exist. They just kind of assimilated. Their nationality just ran into the sand in foreign territory. And so Israel were seriously doubting God, God's sovereignty, God's ability to restore them and recover them. And therefore, Isaiah here brings to them a message about the unrivaled sovereignty of God. How great is our God, is Isaiah saying. He's saying, sure, no nation has ever recovered from foreign captivity, but no nation has ever had a God like Israel. This is what makes the difference. This is what breaks the cycle. This is what changes history, the uniqueness of Israel's God, who is our God too. And it may be that there are those here this evening who are in situations and circumstances, who are passing through times in their lives when you too maybe are questioning, how great is our God? Not as a worship song, but as a question, as a doubt, even as an accusation. How great is our God? Not how great thou art, but how great art thou? Really? If God was so great, then surely this would be different. If God was so great and so strong, then why would I, his child, be so weak? So let's look at how Isaiah brings here before us, first of all, our awesome God's greatness. Our awesome God's greatness. Notice where Isaiah first points us. He points us, first of all, to God's hand and to one particular place in his hand. He points us to the hollow of his hand. Children, if you cup your hand and you try and put water in it and then pour it into a cup, you'll notice that there's very little that you can actually hold in the hollow of your hand. And even the biggest human hand in the world really couldn't even fill a cup with what would fill the hollow of your hand. Now notice what Isaiah says about God in verse 12. He has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. In other words, God has such a massive hand, he is able to hold all the waters in them. How much water is there in the world? Well, if you think of a cubic mile, that's a cube that's a mile by a mile by a mile. That's a cubic mile. There are 332 million cubic miles of water in the world. 332 million cubic miles of water in the world. About 70% of the world's surface is covered with water. Some areas 10 miles deep. So you can't imagine it, can you? 332 million cubic miles. The Atlantic, the Pacific, all the oceans. And they all gather into one, and God holds them just there. How great is our God? But then he points us, secondly, to God's ruler, or God's measuring tape. Staying in verse 12, he has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out or measured out heaven with the span. Again, children, think of the biggest measuring stick or measuring tape you've got in your house. Go home and find it. What it might be, if you've got a ruler, it might be a meter long or a yard long. If you've got a tape, it might be maybe 25 feet, maybe 100 feet. You can measure quite a lot with that. That's about the biggest human measuring tape we can find. What about God? Let's look at his measuring tape. Do you know what he uses to measure things? That, from pinky to thumb, the span of his hand. You think, well, that's not very much. It's not very much. Just look how much it is. It says he measures out the heaven with a span. How big are the heavens? Well, the nearest star is 4.5 light years away. You know what that means? That means that if light was to leave the nearest star now, traveling at 186,000 miles per second, the speed of light, it would take 4.5 years to reach us. 4.5 years. Something like 26 trillion miles. And God goes like that. In fact, not just to the nearest star, to the furthest away star in our galaxy, to the furthest away star of the furthest galaxy. How great is our God? Then he points us to God's cup, his measuring cup. Staying in verse 12, he comprehends or calculates, is the word. He calculates the dust of the earth, perhaps meaning the sand in the earth, in a measure. And it's actually literally in a third. So it's like a third of a cup. Children, again, go home and you'll find in your mom's kitchen, you'll find measuring cups. Maybe a quarter and a third and a half and one. Go and find the biggest one. And then fill it up with sand and see how much sand you can fill it up with. It's nothing, is it? It's nothing. And here's God. He takes a third of one of his third cup measures. And he takes all the sand around Lake Michigan, all the sand of all the beaches and all the world, and easily gets it into his third cup, third of a cup. He calculates the dust of the earth, the grains of the earth, the sand of the earth, in a measure. How great is our God? Then he points us to God's scales. Staying in verse 12. He weighs the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Imagine that. You might get scales at home and you try and weigh something on it and it reaches a limit, maybe after 10 pounds, 20 pounds, I don't know. But eventually, without much weight, the thing can't register any more weight, that can't take any more. It might even break if you put more on it. And here comes God, and he sets his scales down, and he says, I'll put the Rockies there. Oh, and let's put the Himalayas on. Throw on the Alps for good measure. Don't forget, put on Kilimanjaro while you're at it. Take the highest hills, the greatest mountains. Take them all and put them in my scale. And see if they break. Do you think they break? No. He weighs the mountains. He successfully, he knows the weight of all the mountains all together in his balance. How great is our God? And then Isaiah points us to God's teacher in verse 13 and 14. And the sum and substance is that he doesn't have one. He doesn't have a teacher. Notice what he says. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor has taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge and showed to him the way of understanding? You see, Israel were going to be in Babylon when they were reading this, and Babylon had their own religion. Their primary god, though they had a few, their primary god was called Marduk. And they also had a story about how Marduk allegedly created the world. And in that myth, because that's what it was, it's just a myth, Marduk consults with other so-called gods and sources of wisdom about how to create the world. He seems puzzled. He seems a bit stuck at points. And in fact, he even has opposition to his plans to create. And there's a sort of battle that's built up in this myth of creation. And knowing that Israel were going to be in this, here Isaiah says, look how different is our God. He doesn't have a teacher. He doesn't need advice. He doesn't consult with anyone. And no one can oppose him or confound him. God's never come to anyone anywhere and said, I wonder if you can help me with this. I'd like your opinion. Could you give me some feedback? Maybe we can work this out together. No, Isaiah says, who? Now, these are all rhetorical questions. They're expecting the answer, no one, nothing, ever, anywhere. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? No one. Who, being his counselor, has taught him? No one. With whom took he counsel? No one. Who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment? No one. Who taught him knowledge? No one. Who showed him the way of understanding? No one. Every piece of wisdom and truth has come from within himself. Nothing has come from outside of himself into himself. How great is our God? And then he points us to God's bucket. In verse 15, behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket. So we have this picture, and all of these are just pictures. And they speak of realities. They're not literal realities, but they tell us about real truths. It's using human language to help us conceive of really the inconceivable. It's stretching human conceptions to the farthest limits because God is beyond our limits. But here, Isaiah portrays God as having a bucket. And if we look in the bucket, we see there's a little, there's just a little drop in the bottom of that bucket. Just a little drop of water. And if you look a wee bit closer, like maybe even put your head in that bucket and try and see what's in it, there's America. And look, is that not China? And there's Russia. In fact, all the nations of the world are there in that little drop. All the big nations, all the small nations, all the continents. That's what it says, the nations. They're just like a drop in the bucket. That's how big they are to God. They're not big at all. They're just nothing. It's not saying that God dismisses nations, that he has contempt for nations. It's not saying that at all. It's just saying, however great you think your nation is, God is greater by far. However great you think all the nations of the world are, we see them all gathered in the United Nations, and it's all so impressive, all the flags, all the chauffeuring, all the suits, all the grandeur and the marble, the skyscrapers. Looks so big. And here God says, now let me tell you what I see. It's a little drop in the bucket. How great is our God. In fact, we're told here they're counted as the small dust of the balance. It's just, you see the scale and there's nothing on it, and you look a wee bit closer and you see in certain light there's a wee bit of dust there. Let me just brush that off. Oh, that was all the nations of the world. That was all the nations. How great is our God? Look at God's sacrifice in verse 16. Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. Again, we're asked to picture something here. Lebanon was famous for its beautiful forest of cedar trees, very rich, rare, valuable wood that was really rarely used for sacrifice. But here, we're asked to conceive of this, that somebody went in one day and chopped down all the cedars of Lebanon, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, that covered all the mountains around about Israel, and brought them all together and stripped them of their leaves and started making a pile up to the heavens as high as you can go. Log after log, branch after branch, trunk after trunk, all of Lebanon's cedars here. So way above what you can see. And then, somehow or other, all the beasts are brought. All the cattle, all the sheep, all the goats, every beast you can imagine, they're brought to be a burnt offering. So you've got this massive altar, you've got this mass of beasts, and you think, that's too much. That's too much to sacrifice to God, surely. And Isaiah says, it's too little. It's too little. He says, Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. He's saying, no matter how valuable the wood, no matter how numerous the beasts, it's still an offering unworthy of this great God. How great is our God? And then verse 17, we see God's calculator. All nations before him are as nothing. They're counted to him less than nothing and vanity. Again, we're asked to sort of imagine someone sitting there and they're totting up, they're calculating the value of all the nations. They're bringing together the GDP of all the nations, the balance of payments from all the nations and totting them up in a calculator, and you're thinking, you know, this calculator is going to run out of numbers. There aren't going to be enough columns for the zeros for this calculation of the value of all world trade and all world nations and all the value of all the property in all the world. And then we read, actually what's on the calculator is a zero. Without a one or anything before, it's just zero. All the nations before him are as nothing. In fact, it says they're counted to him less than nothing. You can't actually get less than nothing, but he's using a sort of literary device here to underline how much of a big, fat zero this all amounts to. It's a vacuum. It's a vanity. And that brings us to God's mirror. In verse 18, after all that we've looked at all these things, and then in verse 18, it's as if Isaiah, it brings us in front of a mirror, and in that mirror we see God. And Isaiah says, okay, who are you going to compare him to? Who are you going to put beside him in this mirror? To whom will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare unto him? And remember, he's speaking first of all and foremost to Israel and Babylon, who are seeing this pantheon of gods all around with all their claims. They're seeing all these idols, and they're being tempted. They have seen these idols win and God lose. And they're being tempted to say, well, maybe they've got something. And after listing all these attributes of God's greatness, all these characteristics of God's greatness, Isaiah says, I dare you to put someone beside God in this mirror and say, oh, they look quite similar. He says, what are you comparing here? Here we've got the God who made man, and you're thinking about a man-made God? That's what he describes here. As people make graven images to worship. How great is our God? He's incomparable. And then in verse 22, we have God's seat. We're told he sits upon the circle of the earth, probably speaking of the horizon. You go out to Lake Michigan and you look across and you see there's a slight bend as you look out, if you look carefully enough. It's the horizon. And you see, man, it goes from way over there. Way over. As far as you can see that way, as far as you can see that way. And Isaiah says here, God's seat. That's how great God is. You measure the greatness of God by the greatness of his seat. Again, they were used to seeing the ruler of Babylon, the emperor who they viewed as a god within Babylon, sitting on this massive throne, and again, very impressive, very imposing, very persuasive. And Isaiah says, that's nothing. That's just like a foldaway camp chair compared to this seat of our God. How great is our God? And then he points us to God's grasshoppers. We see that again in verse 22. He sits on the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. You know what you think of a grasshopper, don't you? You don't think of them really at all. What does a grasshopper do for you? You hear them, you think, that's nice, but a grasshopper, it's nothing. 7.5 billion people populate the world tonight. 7.5 billion people. And God looks down and he says, little grasshopper. Grasshopper Trump, grasshopper Clinton, grasshopper Gates, grasshopper everyone, all the inhabitants of the earth are as grasshoppers. But God's got a tent as well. He's got a tent. We read here, in verse 22, he stretches out the heavens as a curtain. And just as an aside, you think of how easy it is. You go home and you open the curtains. Here he's saying, God stretches out the heavens as easily as you open the curtains. He put that all up there as easily as you opening the curtains. He spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. God is so great, he needs the whole universe to be his tent. And he fills it all. How great is our God that fills heaven and earth? What about God's politics? This is God's view of politics in verses 23 and 24. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth as vanity. He looks at, again, as Israel are looking out, they're seeing these kings and emperors and judges and rulers, and they seem so settled, so stable, so sure, so secure. And here's God's view of politics. I can bring them to nothing. I can make the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, they shall not be sown, their stalk shall not take root in the earth. He shall blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. No wonder he says in verse 25, to whom will you liken me? He's saying, how great am I? Verse 26 points us to God's sky. Lift up your eyes on high and behold who has created these things. He brings out their host, that's the stars by number. He calls them all by names by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one fails. Do you know how many galaxies there are in the world? We're in one galaxy, Milky Way. You know how many galaxies there are estimated to be in the world? 10 trillion. 10 trillion galaxies in the universe. 10 years ago, they thought 100 billion. Now they've added a few more zeros. And if our galaxy is anything to go by, it has 100 billion stars. 100 billion stars. It's mind-boggling, isn't it? You find zeros just multiplying. In fact, if you were to take 10 trillion galaxies and 100 billion stars in each galaxy, put a 1 and then 24 zeros after it, that's how many stars there are. And what does God say? He numbers them. He has names for them all. And he sustains them. One with 24 zeros, he can actually count them all. He can name them all. And he keeps them all hanging there perfectly every day. How great is our God? See what Isaiah's doing? He's pointing to God's creation and providence, and he's saying, the God who can do this will keep his promises. The God who is this will keep his promises. Don't doubt it. His promises to Israel, his promises to his people. His greatness is his guarantee. God will keep his promises, but surely also this whole passage calls us to wonder and worship. We think of perhaps Revelation 15 and verse 4, where after giving another awesome description of the greatness of God, this question sort of instinctively erupts in heaven. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? Who can read Isaiah 40 and not come away with that great question? Who shall not fear thee? What madness would it be not to fear this God? How insane would it be? How crazed can we be to have no fear of this God? It leads us to wonder, it leads us to worship, it leads us to awe. The awesome greatness of our God. But I want to point one other thing out to you, which is really, if our minds are still intact after trying to conceive the inconceivable, tack this on. If you've got space left in this little place for another mind-blowing thought, think of the not just the awesome greatness of our God, but the awesome gentleness of our God. Because notice the bookends of this whole section, what comes before it and what comes after it. verse 11. In fact, read verse 10. Behold, the Lord God will come with strong hand. His arm shall rule for him. His reward is with him and his work before him. And then this incredibly gentle image comes. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. Isn't that incredible? Such a great God, a God with so much greatness, can also be characterized by so much gentleness. That he presents himself in this most tender, sympathetic of images of a shepherd. He brings these mighty arms, these great arms, and he says, I'm going to use them to feed my flock like a shepherd. To pick up the little ones in my arms and carry them near to my chest. And those who are with young, I'm going to give them special care. Imagine again, you're in Babylon. And you feel like you've been deserted and abandoned. Then Isaiah comes with this awesome God, and in some ways you might just totally shrink back and think, this is overwhelming, this is too much. And then he says, but remember, this great God is also a gentle God. And he devotes his greatness to gently ministering to his people. Again, go to the other bookend at the end of this section. And he says in verse 26, verse 27, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my judgment is passed over from my God? Why are you saying this, Israel, in Babylon? Have you not known, have you not heard, that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, faints not, neither is weary, there is no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the faint. And to them that have no might, he increases strength. This massive, magnificent, majestic God is scanning the earth, and he's looking for the weak. He's not the kind of great person who will only associate with the great. The exact opposite. He's saying, where are the faint? Where are the weak? Where are those who are giving up? Where are those who say, I have no strength? To them, he gives power. Why don't you plead that? This is how to bring the greatness of God into the weakness of our lives. This is what connects us with this great God. This is what puts us in touch with this divine current of supernatural and immeasurable power, a confession of weakness. Confession of I'm fainting. A confession of I can't. I'm not up to it. I'm failing. I'm fainting. The youth, even the youth, this can be true of young people too. It's not just old people who grow weary and weak. Young people do too. They're stressed. They're faint. They're on the verge of giving up. They're cast down. They're not what they want to be. They're not even what they used to be. They're nowhere near where they plan to be. Things have gone pear-shaped in their lives. And here we're told, yes, even the youths shall faint. Even young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait, it's not promising instant results, but they that wait upon the Lord, they who cast themselves upon him and say, I'm not going, I'm not leaving, I'm not giving up on you. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength, shall receive heavenly current, divine voltage, renewal of energy, motive, mission, purpose. Renewal of physical strength, maybe. Renewal of mental strength, emotional strength, maybe. Certainly, renewal of spiritual strength. So much so, they shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. If God's greatness makes us wonder and worship, surely his gentleness in conjunction with that greatness does even more. We surely come and sing, O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made. I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed. Then sings my soul, my God, how great thou art, my Savior, my God. How great is our God. Name above all names, worthy of all praise, my heart will sing, how great is our God. How great is our God? Sing with me. How great is our God? And all will see how great is our God. Let's pray.